One thing that may be surprising to some folks is that back in the 80s, there was actually over a million acres of soybeans in the state. And the reason for that was because of the issues we were having in cotton. And so they were, you know, they were having to switch to beans or any other crop that could keep them above water. And so, you know, we've done a really good job of mitigating some of those pressures. And I think that still holds true now on why we don't see more adoption. Some of the challenges that we have is from a pest perspective in the extreme heat that we get down here. The disease pressure is just unrelenting. I mean, it's just, you know, it's by far one of the bigger challenges that we have is just staying on top of the disease pressure.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Brian Arnell, and I'm coming to you from the campus of Oklahoma State University. Today, we're excited to have on Dr. Nick Shea. He's the Assistant Professor, Extension Small Grains Agronomist at the University of Georgia. Nick is based out of the UGA Tifton campus and leads the extension research efforts in corn, soybeans, and small grains across Georgia. As a specialist in weed science and crop productivity, Dr. Shea earned his PhD and MS from UGA and is now really focusing on the agronomic management of all those crops in Georgia that I've already mentioned, corn, beans, grain sorghum, and all the other small grains. And really, he's a jack of all trades from early conversations with Nick. Nick, excited to have a visit with you today. Thanks for being on with us.
Thanks, Brian. I really appreciate being here and sharing a little bit of my story with your audience.
Yeah. So speaking of your story, share with us your path to your position, right? How'd you end up being where you're at?
Yeah, I think a lot of folks can have a very similar story to mine. I grew up in a rural area in western New York State in the Finger Lakes region. I always tell folks that there were more dairy cows than there were people in my town. But I actually didn't grow up on a farm. I grew up in town. I was a townie, as they say, back up north. But my grandfather owned 200 acres a mile up the road, and so I would ride my bicycle up there. And I remember as a kid, my grandfather, he would swing on by with his late 80s Toyota Tacoma, and he would open the door and say, "Come on, jump on in, let's go for a ride." And so he would take me for a ride up the road to the farm, and we would bush hog, and it was just a recreational piece of ground. And he had it in a CRP program for quite some time. And so that was kind of my introduction to agriculture and land stewardship, and how I really started my career path was down the environmental science side of things and land management from that perspective. And so my grandfather was the biggest influence in pursuing that. But as I got deeper into environmental science and doing environmental research and looking at a lot of soil mitigation work and working with, you know, reclamation sites and Superfund sites, I was drawn back to my childhood memories of growing up around dairy and around agriculture. And that's kind of the community I wanted to get back involved with. And so I had an opportunity while living here in Georgia to attend the University of Georgia, both for my master's and PhD, and never looked back. Had to convince my wife to move to a small town as a city girl that she is from Atlanta. But yeah, it's been a great trip thus far. And, you know, I've really had an opportunity to learn both from an early career extension specialist in my master's, and then under the direction of Eric Prosco in weed science for my PhD. And so between the both of those very dynamic perspectives, it's really helped to shape my early career and give me a lot of stuff to work with hitting the ground running in my current position.
Kind of, I guess just to touch more into that, talk a little bit or Tell us a little bit about the Tifton campus, because you're not on main campus, right? You're not in the central part of UGA, but you're actually on the Tifton campus, which is a remote campus. Tell us a little bit about Tifton.
Yeah, Tifton is very unique. I'm sure most folks in the agriculture industry have heard of Tifton, Georgia before. If you're not an ag, as my wife being from Atlanta, she had no idea where Tifton was. And I was like, well, you're from Georgia. You should know where it is. But what an incredible place to do research and to collaborate. It's really a family environment down here. And you know, the wealth of knowledge that's here and the opportunities that exist right outside my door, my office door, you know, whether that's colleagues or stepping foot on multiple different farms that are, you know, within a 5-minute drive from campus is really unique for Tifton. And being right off of Highway 75, I mean, it's just a corridor. We have great partnerships with ABAC, you know, the Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College. And, you know, so we really get to help young students in the development of their education and their careers. And so it's a well-oiled machine here. I'm just kind of stepping into it and benefiting from all of the hard work and the vision that people have cast over the years here in Tifton.
Yeah, I just have to say on a personal note that I've had a nice run through of ABAC students. I've got two that have gone through, one's about to wrap up. And so it's always a great resource of just amazing students that come through. They work hard, they're genuine, and they really know how to get down to business. But I guess going on to what you're doing down there, Nick, can you tell us a little bit about your extension and research program?
You know, this position in particular, you know, cotton and peanut are king here in Georgia, right? And so there's a lot of really good support for the small grains and for corn and soybeans. People are hungry for the knowledge. And so, you know, over the last few years, you know, you could even say the last 10 years, this role has had some inconsistencies. And so people are excited about the opportunity to have some, you know, a fresh look at new ideas in grain production here in the state. And, you know, our environment is really challenging. But with that being said, you know, we have such a long growing season that provides a tremendous amount of opportunity to do some really unique things and different integrated approaches to how we produce corn and beans that really doesn't happen anywhere else in the country. And so, you know, a lot of my efforts are really looking at some of those unique strategies to incorporate corn and beans in a rotation that may not be as common in other places. Same with grain sorghum. Grain sorghum is a very unique opportunity for us here too. And we can really double crop within the same growing season and maximize that land use. You know, putting on the agronomic hat and coming from weed science, you know, some folks say a weed scientist makes a great agronomist. Depends on who you talk to. But, you know, I've had a really good experience working under Dr. Prosco and his program, and the way he runs things is really agronomically minded, even though it's weed science focused. And so I bring a lot of that over to this position. And what I've seen in my first year, just finished up my first year, is, you know, people are really trying to maximize the tools they already have. And I think that's where a lot of my focus is right now, especially in our market and some of the concerns that we have. You know, folks are clawing at ideas and ways to maximize what they currently have. And you know, whether that's land, irrigation, equipment, technology, and making sure that they are what some folks call the master of the mundane, right? And it doesn't always take the shiny new thing, but if we can really pay attention to the details and make sure we're timely with our agronomic strategy, then we can be successful and come out on top and be profitable at the end of the day.
So if I think Tifton, you know, in my head, and I'm picturing Tifton, and I'm picturing the farm ground around Tifton, I immediately, and you've already mentioned a couple, I immediately go cotton, I immediately go peanuts, and I think pecans, and just because we're in where I'm at, I think a lot of Bermuda grass with Tifton and Tiftway and all that stuff. And you're trying to bring in, and you're trying to introduce more crop rotation. What's some of the challenges around, and why isn't corn, beans as dominant, and why has it always been cotton and peanuts in that ground?
Yeah, great question. I think, you know, Brian, the one thing that may be surprising to some folks is that back in the 80s, there was actually over a million acres of soybeans in the state. And the reason for that was because of the issues we were having in cotton. And so they were, you know, they were having to switch to beans or any other crop that could keep them above water. And so, you know, we've done a really good job of mitigating some of those pressures. And I think that still holds true now on why we don't see more adoption. Some of the challenges that we have is from a pest perspective in the extreme heat that we get down here. The disease pressure is just unrelenting. I mean, it's just, you know, it's by far one of the bigger challenges that we have is just staying on top of the disease pressure, which it can be done. We've come a long way with hybrid selection and variety selection and some of our pest management strategies that we have. You know, as far as increasing adoption from here on out, we've gotten very comfortable in the systems that we have. And so it brings up a challenge outside of just agriculture and the producer themselves, because the surrounding communities are such a big part of peanut and cotton production. And those systems are rock solid. Even with the prices that we're seeing now, the whole community depends on these two crops. And so trying to get away from that is really difficult because we abandoned a lot of the infrastructure for soybeans back in the 80s. And so rebuilding that at you know, when you look at our current environment and some of the pricing concerns we have, that's our biggest challenge outside of the disease pressure is where do we go with all this product? How do we store it when the infrastructure isn't there anymore?
Well, I mean, I'm even thinking as you're talking that, I'm thinking, you know, your wide row on both peanuts and most of your cotton's wide row versus like the corn belt, right? You're not a lot of 30s on cotton. I'm assuming a lot of 40, 36, 40, and even 42s. Your peanuts are typically wide row. So now your planters are not set up for that. And if you're doing soybeans, you could do drills, but how many are those? Probably don't have a ton of platform headers running around or draper headers, everything set up for picking cotton and picking peanuts. And so infrastructure wise, and then as you talk about storage, who's going to take that? But even with those constraints, there's value in having that crop rotation. And so dig in. I don't know which way. I'm kind of intrigued in both. You pick, you know, is it the constraints you want to talk about or the added value bringing those crops in or combination?
Yeah, no, I think talking about the added value is always a better way, a better perspective to look at things. You know, like I had mentioned, our growing season is so long. There is tremendous opportunity to maximize land use here. And even in the face of all the things I've said before, you know, that integrated approach that we have here can really diversify and mitigate a lot of the risk that growers have if they're dependent on one crop. Are there challenges with equipment? Yeah, but we've kind of addressed that. You know, a lot of folks are on 36 inch peanuts. There's at least 50% of our peanuts are twin row now. And so that's something that's picking up here as well as more twin row stuff. And it's kind of a phase. It came in for a little while and then it left and now it's coming back again for twin row beans and corn.
That's intriguing there.
Yeah, it really is. And so it's some stuff to really investigate on my end that I have to kind of make sure I can answer those questions. You know, the herbicide deal and when you look at the ESA and the EPA and some of the challenges that presents us in now and into the future, I think being able to diversify the crops we're using can help us get those mitigation points that we need. Not depending on one crop to make ends meet. And we can, depending on the year, you know, if you have a really bad spring and you know that you're not able to get your corn out, you can still get a bean in, or you can still, as long as the supply is there, that would be a concern. But there's just a lot of opportunity to, for instance, I'm thinking here, you know, when you're talking about peanut, for instance, usually our rotation is 2 years of cotton and then a year of peanut, and really trying to reduce that disease pressure that we get in peanut. Now, folks are throwing in a year of corn as well, giving you another year in there to help out with that the peanut performance. And so those are things that are continuing to be integrated to really help us on the disease and pest pressure mitigation strategy. And there's some new markets that are always on the horizon here in Georgia, especially with having one of the busiest ports in the country out of Savannah. There's a constant pull from agriculture groups looking at ways to kind of take advantage of Georgia's market and how they can utilize some of our commodities in that regard without having to go, you know, too deep into the internal part of the country to get what they need. So there's just a lot of Georgia's growing. There's a lot of opportunity here to hit some of those more niche markets.
So in that rotation, that cotton peanut rotation, does corn versus soy or sorghum have more logical value as far as maybe IPM or other management strategies?
Yeah, definitely corn. We're seeing some issues with a soybean peanut rotation. It's the disease. White mold is a big one. Red crown rot is another one that we have a lot of concern with those two rotations. I think we've come a long way with genetics and some of our disease packages and other products that are available to us that we can use in season. And I think it hasn't been investigated in a while. And I know there's a deep desire from a lot of folks, a lot of soybean folks here, or peanut growers who are interested in adding soybean into the rotation, on revisiting that topic and be like, hey, if disease pressure really is our biggest hurdle we need to get over, with all of these products that we have available to us now, since it's been a while since we've looked at it, how about we revisit that and see what can we do? And so that's a conversation I'm having with Scott Mumford, who's the peanut agronomist here, and Scott Tubbs, who is a systems agronomist here as well. And we're kind of discussing those and working out some of the finer details of what that looks like and how we can put a strategy together to look at some of these factors.
Now, if I'm thinking of a farm scale, can you lay out what the planting and harvest window looks like if I'm really trying to integrate cotton, peanut, and corn, or even throw in soy? What's that kind of window of progression from early spring all the way to the end?
It definitely depends on where you are in the state, right? Georgia's a really big state. For this side of the Mississippi, I should say. but we have some very diverse regions in the state. You know, we have the mountainous region, we have the Piedmonts, the coastal plains. And so it depends on where you are on what that strategy looks like. Now, based in the coastal plains area, a lot of the corn production, most of the peanut production happens here in the coastal plains, but cotton's grown across the entire state. Same with corn and soybeans. So it depends on where you are. So let's say we're speaking only for the coastal plains right now for this conversation.
Yep. Yeah.
So in our area, which some people in the Midwest, this may blow their minds, but we can plant corn at the end of February, beginning of March. We really have to. We don't have an option to go in later because of the heat stress, the extreme heat that we get during the middle of the season, really at that critical point when you're looking at June or July, that's when we're pollinating. That's when we're transitioning to reproductive stage growth. And so we have to get ahead of that by planting as early as possible. And so really that happens March first week. On average, I would say it was probably the first or second week of March for the coastal plains. So that gives you time to get your corn acres in. And then some folks, like depending on the type of, peanut variety that you're growing, we have some that take a little bit longer to mature. So some folks will start maybe that last week of April, second to last week of April. And then they're trying to decide when to cut off and pick up cotton. You know, cotton's in May. Soybeans for us, anything after May 15th, you're starting to take a yield hit. So that the first 2 weeks of May are critical for soybean. And so that's a delicate balance that they have to look at. And it's a challenge for them because they have to figure out, okay, when do I cut off peanut production and start cotton or stop cotton and switch to soybeans. Now, I would say there's not many folks who are growing cotton and soybeans. Most guys are, I'm a soybean guy or I'm a cotton guy. There's not
that
both.
Makes sense.
So that's kind of just a very, very basic overview of what that timeline looks like. And so you can see that the challenges that exist there when you have so many crops and pest management strategies, weed control, insect control, fungicide across all of those differing systems can be a challenge.
Now throw in, because I'm just going to throw in a wrench in this because we've been talking all summer crops. You also handle the small grains, which would include wheat, oats, any of those small grains, along with winter canola. So tell me about your small grains along those lines. What's it look like, at least in the Tifton in that coastal plain area?
In the coastal plain area, most of the folks here are growing oats that they're using to graze cattle. Or they're using cereal rye for cover crop. There's not many folks down here that are growing wheat or any grain really for harvest. They're using that mainly as a cover or using it for cattle grazing. We just have a really challenging environment. The vernalization requirement, we just don't have. We just don't get enough cold days down here. We do have some varieties that work well, and we can get a good crop. I mean, we could make 90 to 100 bushels if you're really pushing it and you got some good ground. But most of that, I would say, is happening up in the middle part of Georgia when you get towards the Piedmonts. That's where you're actually starting to see folks that are producing a decent crop out of a wheat. Mainly wheat is the main one that they're using to grow. Some oats as well. It really depends. Our market's very small here, so the contracts that folks are getting are for some more of the niche markets.
That makes sense.
Since we've lost most of the processing facilities here in the state for small grains, it's usually having to get it shipped out of the state.
So Nick, we've got a crop up here in Oklahoma that's really special to us in Oklahoma and Kansas, primarily because we're hot and dry and we have shallow soils, but you mentioned it. So tell me a little bit about grain sorghum in Georgia, because that doesn't really pop to my mind, because we're always putting grain sorghum where the ground's too tough for corn. So tell me about grain sorghum in Georgia.
Yeah, it's it can thrive here. It's a unique crop. The opportunities to really help with profit, with the reduction in inputs, it works well on our dry land acres here. We have a lot of dry land corn. I do recommend and try to suggest and steer people towards grain sorghum. One, I'm passionate about it, but two, it makes sense in my mind as far as input strategy and really the best opportunity for success when you think about how every year for us, it's different. We have a drought, we have way too much rain. And so on our dry land acres, grain sorghum just makes sense. And the input strategy, our soils, whether you're on a clay soil or a sandy soil, it performs well. You give it the base, its basic needs, you meet those basic requirements, and grain sorghum with our heat units, just, it does well. The only caveat with that is most grain sorghum is not, they're not developing new lines of grain sorghum for Georgia.
Yeah.
So no. We have issues with anthracnose. That is our biggest hurdle. If we have a variety that's great with anthracnose and we can control the sugarcane aphid, man, we can see some amazing yields here in Georgia. And we have a really robust industry for that as a product when you're thinking about the broiler market that we have here, the recreational industry that we have here for outdoor activities, all of the plantations here. And so it's a no-brainer for me just based on the reduction in inputs, and it's a beautiful crop, and it performs well in our environment if you control disease.
Yeah, I have no doubt. In fact, we always try to, you know, at least around here, it has enough of a reputation where it can just struggle through everything that a lot of producers don't give its true opportunity. And so, you know, they're happy with 60 and 70 bushel by basically doing nothing, throwing some seed in the ground and a little bit of herbicide, a little atrazine and dual, and then coming back with a combine. But yeah, I mean, it's an amazing crop on its potential. And in the climates, and while our climate is variable and dry here, your country, I know, has a lot of climate. I mean, I was getting tons of pictures this year from Tifton about the cotton crop, both before and after the Jacid came in and through. So, you know, just seeing the struggle of getting the crop in and up. And so, yeah, just it's that stable workhorse for us where, yeah, I might be able to get really good corn yields one in a couple years. But I'll follow a really good corn year with a really bad corn year. At least sorghum, I'm cutting that check to the banker every year where I could pay for my bills because it's performing diligently every year.
It's time for our famous three.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
So that does, Nick, we're out of time. So I'm going to hit you with our three final questions. What has been a good go-to work resource for you when you have questions?
A good go-to work resource is, you know, I can't speak highly enough of my Tifton community. I mean, every door is always open here. All of the extension specialists on this campus, everybody's on speed dial. That is my go-to resource. Them, the stakeholders in the state, we just have a really rich community here and a lot of support from all industries, not just the university side of things. And so there's several folks, you know, from Pioneer, from you name it, any of the industry, it's rich. And there's the support there. And so I lean heavily on those folks. They've been there, done that. And they're the ones that are helping build this program out. And I'm just executing by taking in the wealth of knowledge that exists around me.
So I know as an assistant prof, you have a ton of free time. So what do you do in your free time?
Oh, man, I have three kids. So that's where all my time goes. Yep. I have a 7-year-old, a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. So that takes up a lot of time. I mean, I'm an outdoor enthusiast at heart. So I'm hunting, I'm fishing. I used to train horses. So I'm always dabbling in horses when I can. And that keeps me busy with any free time that I have.
And finally, where do people go to find out more about your work and your program?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the University of Georgia, the Extension program, it's easy to find the Georgia Grains team on there. And we're also on social media trying to increase our our footprint on social media. We've done some pretty cool things this year, exciting for what next year is going to hold for us too. So you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, all of those major platforms at Georgia Grains Team is our handle. And so we're on there, and we're happy to communicate with you and open to comments, concerns, and suggestions.
Well, folks, that wraps up another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wyzenetics. Thanks for joining us today with our guest, Dr. Nick Shea, Assistant Professor, Extension Grains Agronomist at the University of Georgia. Remember, if you enjoyed this podcast, subscribe, hit that subscribe button so you get notifications every time we drop a new one. Also, share this video with peers and friends if you've enjoyed it today. Get the Crop Science Podcast Show shared out there. And as always, leave us any comments or suggestions if you have questions for our past guest or suggestions for new guests. Dr. Shea, thank you so much for joining. It's been a pleasure. I look forward to keeping track of you as you go through your career.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate it. Had a blast.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.